it, I can't be afraid now. Put me on the stage now, I'm ready to rage now. I feel like an animal stuck in a cage and I'm ready to break out.
Hey guys, Jay here, and welcome to the Mindset with Muscle podcast. And I've got a very special guest with me today, celebrating the release of his brand new documentary, Breaking Olympia, seven-time Mr. Olympia, Phil Heath. Phil, how are you?
Fantastic, man. So happy to be here, brother.
I'm super excited about this. And oh, yeah. One of the things I really want to delve into, of course, is just the mindset, unpacking some things and just giving the viewers and listeners some little tidbits of information to help them get the most out of their day, get the most out of their life, in fact. And I want to kickstart from the beginning with a quote, and it's one of my favorite quotes, Phil. Environment dictates performance.
Ooh.
Growing up in Seattle, it sounds like you had a great environment around you of people that poured into you.
Mm-hmm.
So can you take us back to those basketball days in Seattle and what it was like growing up there?
Oh man, it was pretty awesome when you're growing up and you're in the 80s, where in the NBA there was a guy by the name of Michael Jeffrey Jordan that just came onto the scene.
I've heard of him, yeah.
Yeah, you know, he had this swagger about him, right? And you know, you're able to watch his greatness, but then also get to watch Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, all these amazing athletes. And then also see people like Jerry Rice, you know, Joe Montana. We're talking anything in baseball or football, such as Bo Jackson, who played two freaking sports. And that was a great time to be alive, because as a child, you always wanted to see these superheroes in comic books. But I got to see people that could run fast, that could jump high, that could do some amazing things in real life. I just wanted to be able to do those same things someday. Every kid wanted to be able to jump out the gym like Michael Jordan, stick his tongue out and shoot three-pointers, say, Jordan, you know, stuff like that. And we all knew what that meant. That meant that you were doing something epic. It was just a great time, because all of my friends were into it also. So it wasn't like I was the only kid on the block that was into a sport. We all were into sports. We were all into boxing. I mean, imagine growing up and you're able to see Mike Tyson's first championship win with Michael Spinks. I was able to watch that like in an adult environment, you know, with my stepdad, and just like, wow. So then every kid had something to say about sports. Everything was sports driven. But within that derived competition. Every kid was highly competitive. So all the kids I grew up with, it was always about who's the fastest, who could jump the highest, who could stretch the furthest, you know, all these things. Who could touch the net? You know, you're 10 years old trying to just touch the net. We're buying those Nerf baskets in the house. And I think I tore up my, I tore up the, one door and then one closet door, because you had to put the, you know, you had to hang it over the door and then close the door. And then you try to jump. And then you realize you jump so high, you dunk it and you yank it. And then the door comes off. So yeah, everything was about power, finesse, I mean, efficiency. But that really helped me, because that coincided with scholastic achievement as well. Like, be the best. Who could spell the best? Spelling bees, you know, like, were a big thing. Every, you know, math, what do you call it? Mathathons or whatever, you know, who could do the times tables the fastest? Everything was about, like, who's the best? And I give a lot of credit to the guys I grew up with, because we all, you know, had parents that were really hard on us, almost to the point where it was probably somewhat, it would be considered toxic in today's society. But majority of us didn't go to jail. Majority of us are now, you know, living a really good life. And it's because of the fact that, for those that listened, you know, had those foundational principles that, you know, are of high quality standards.
Competition against talent. I think that is something about that performance thing, because mm-hmm. I think there's this old quote, is if you're the strongest person in the gym, you're in the wrong gym.
Mm-hmm.
And it's having people around you that are better than you that makes you better. So having that talent pool around you, there's a certain standard around you that normally people would just kind of stop or think that's enough. in actual fact, you can see what's possible around you. So I think it's incredible. Something that you said there as well, Phil, was about the whole word kind of toxic. And obviously in news, there's been reports on, I think it was the Navy SEALs going a bit too far with their soldiers. And it's just like, they're Navy SEALs. And it's just, yeah.
That's pretty wild. Mm. And who are these people criticizing? These talented individuals that are doing this for what purpose? To restore freedom. I mean, you need the person that is going to save your life to be the actual Rambo, you know? You need them to be able to do these things.
Yeah.
And it is quite, what would be the word, unfathomable for the average person who never worked out a day in their life, never has been a star athlete, to criticize someone who is. And all they want to do is be the strongest, the fastest. And these guys are highly intelligent, too. They know things that, you talk about a frogman. I mean, there's a lot that goes into that. They have to know so much stuff and be able to do that underwater, doing demo, doing missions that a kid would be playing on a video game, but they can do it in real life. If anything, we should be applauding these people to have the willingness to go out and defend the freedom of countrymen. You know, because there's a lot of people, a lot of countries that need liberation. And I'm all for, military to do the right thing. But to say that it's toxic for them to, I just can't understand a layman, a common person criticizing an elite athlete.
I think they're just trying to put themselves in that person's shoes and think there's no way I can do it. But that's just like.
Then just say it.
Yeah.
Hey, it's not for me. Like for me, I was recruited, in college to play basketball by not just the University of Denver where I played at, but one of them was the United States Air Force Academy. And, I had a affinity for the military, but also I was into computers. So I'm thinking, I'll major in computer science or computer engineering, and the Air Force would be able to, take care of me thereafter. And the only reason, to be honest, the only reason why I didn't sign up was because I was more into living a college life along with playing ball, not serving. And was that cowardice? Maybe, but that was more of me being realistic. But since then, I stayed respectful of those men and women who do serve, not just in America, but all around, and recognize that, what can I do as a civilian? Well, I do things with our, USO and stuff like that. And I always say, thank you for your service. I'll thank you for your service and stuff like that, because those things are important, but they all come with standards.
Yeah.
And I remember asking the guy who was recruiting me, what's a typical day? So he tells me, you get up at 4:45, you do this, this, and this, and you're going to go to practice. And then after that, you're going to have, classes here, do this. And my dumb ass decided to say, so what do we do on weekends?
It's weekends?
He's like, weekends? And he just looked at me and he just knew right away. He's like, I don't think this is for you, son. And I was like, you know what? You're probably right.
I want to talk a little bit about Mike Mathieu and his approach to coaching, because he had a bit of a different approach to people. And I think that is such an important thing to talk about, where there's this whole thing of the carrot and the stick, be nice to people, empathize. And there's also, giving people the stick, telling them what they need to hear, yelling and getting results. And I always said, look, if a person can't be told, they need to be violently shaken, because there is a level of extreme and people respond to different things. So how was that for you in basketball growing up, seeing that, and how did that affect your performance?
I mean, I saw that the minute I played on an actual local recreational league team. My first interaction was with a coach by the name of James Prather, and that guy, you ever watched, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's a movie called The Bad News Bears. And it's a baseball story about a coach that was kind of like a drunk, and he would coach these kids that were kind of like flunkies and made them into something. And while he's making them into something, they were making something into him. That coach was, same with us, just a bunch of kids that just wanted to play ball, and he had some things going on in his personal life, and we all kind of like rallied together. And I mean, he was kind of like an alcoholic. Like, he would come to the games and cuss us out, and we were like 10-year-old kids. But then I think about it, yeah, John, like, he was a dumbass for doing that, like, you know, and he had to be yelled at. But obviously today's world, like, a kid that would get yelled at, oh man, the parents would try to get him fired. And in fact, when I got into high school, the coach that I played for, Mike Bethea, he's still there to this day. He was very stern. But what's funny is that this was the same coach that would love you so hard that his words were loud, but he was trying to extract the talent so you could see how great you are. So one instance, I was playing varsity, and he's pissed at me because I'm going down court and I'm just laying the ball up and it's getting beat off the glass. You know, like you see like LeBron James chase down blocks. He's just beating the hell out of this ball. So he benches me. I sit down and he hits me on the arm, like, just like, man, wake up, you know? And I remember my mom was so pissed, like, to the point, you know, she was like headed to PTSA. So she wanted to get him fired, you know? And I was like, Mom, like, chill out. Like, this guy is the same coach, the same man that has given one of my teammates clothes because he's homeless. He's the same one that gave one of our teammates his own car to take a girl to winter ball. It's the same one that has given gas money or like money for food to go watch a football team play. So yeah, he's just pissed off, you know, because he knows what he believes in. And he really laid into me. And yeah, it was intimidating, but I had to sit there and ask myself, is he right? Well, go for it then. So I remember I went back in the game and I laid the ball up again. And he benched me again. And then halftime, he makes me run. So what happens after that? I get pissed off because now I'm embarrassed. And he's probably like, oh, yeah, now it worked. So I go back in the game and guess what happens? I get a steal. I go down the court and I dunk it. And I dunk that thing so freaking hard. And it was almost like I'm looking at him like, F you, you know? But then it clicked. It clicked. What did I just accomplish? And it did require him to shake me almost violently to get it done. So I definitely believe that it's necessary sometimes. I think that the coach needs to have that self-awareness also of picking and choosing when that's, you know, the right time in sport. Now it has to just be with words. You can't like put your hands on anybody, unfortunately, to a degree. I mean, you slap a guy on the butt and be like, come on, man, let's go. You know, it's not beating him, you know, but I definitely believe that if I were to coach right now, it'd be very difficult because I'd have to tell the parents, hey, look, like, I love these kids. I think they're great, but I need you to be great too. And yes, if I yell, it's because I do love them. Yep. You think I want 100%. Them to lose? Losing sucks. I don't want participation medals. I don't want those types. You, if that's who you are, go play for someone else. I'm here to win. You don't go to work to lose.
Yeah, 100%. You know? It reminds me, there's a book called The Last Lecture. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a guy who finds out he's got terminal cancer and a few months left to live. And it's all about him giving he's a teacher, giving his last lecture. And he was talking about, I think it was baseball or basketball, and his coach being really aggressive to them and him walking into the changing room really down. And I just thought I'd quote this to you. Coach Graham rode you pretty hard, didn't he? He said, I could barely muster a yeah. That's a good thing, the assistant told me. When you're screwing up and nobody says anything to you anymore, it means they've given up on you. And, you know, I resonate so much with that because it's like that emotion and drive is about not, you know, not them telling you you're stupid or you're not doing enough. It's like, I know what you can do. Mm-hmm. I know, you know, I'm hard on you for this because you're going to be great one day.
Right.
And it's just that mental flick. And obviously I joined the army at 17. So the whole process of discipline was forced down. You're stripped away as a civilian and it's just, you know, a 17-year-old needs to be yelled at, told what time he has to be there, told how to iron things. And within 3 to 4 months of that kind of lifestyle, completely changed my life.
Yeah.
And you look at some of the 17, 18 year olds these days.
Yeah, they don't have the discipline. And they can't even be talked to, not just being yelled at. They can't even be talked to. If anything, they will not have this eye contact. Mm. I'm sure they, I've seen it, like at events. You'll be pouring into them and then they do this. And at first I started getting, like a couple weeks ago, I'm at the Arnold Classic in Ohio. And I was talking to this kid who asked me a question and he can't look me in the eye more than for 5 seconds at a time. And then his dad was right there and his dad sensed it. So his dad then asked me to look at him. Like he was like, hey, can you say what you just said? And I have my phone right here so I can voice record this so I can play it back for him. And I thought, damn. So he caught it and he didn't. This is a problem. But then I had to say, well, they're too busy doing this the whole day. Mm-hmm. They're doing this the whole day. They've been programmed to do this the whole day. So their attention span is screwed. So yeah, they need to be shaken up a little bit. But yeah, this is a crazy time for us to live. I mean, in all areas. And the biggest area is being a man of intention and knowing why you're here and being able to respect each other's space, but also their time, because there's value and you're missing out on someone's nuggets of wisdom
100%
by just drifting. Like, oh yeah, like I don't care about what you have to say. It's like, well then leave. Don't just stand here so then you can keep holding on to your own energy and giving it to someone else that deserves it. But you know, I definitely resonate with what you're just saying, because man, the coaches that I had are the ones who I thank every time I get a chance to, because they did pour into me and they came from rough upbringings. I could as a grown man now, I can tell, yeah, they did not have it easy, and they would do it all over again because it made them tough. And you know, I think of one of my best coaches. His name is Ron Howard. He was the assistant coach at my high school. That man played for the Dallas Cowboys as a tight end, and he has a Super Bowl ring. So imagine being 13, 14 years old in gym class, because he was our gym teacher at a middle school. Once you see that ring, I still remember it, because his hands are like mangled and stuff from catching that ball and getting hit so hard and pushing people and getting your fingers caught up in face masks and stuff. And he had a knee brace on because he just had ACL surgery at that time. All I remember is that ring. And I was like, right then and there, I'm thinking that whatever's going on with his body, it was worth it. And I love seeing that ring, because only so many people have a Super Bowl ring. So when we won our state championship, I was like so pumped, because I knew that I did something special. And that same coach, get this, that same coach, when we would, he would coach the JV, the junior varsity. He had so many great, talented kids that the varsity was already taken. So you can only play like 10 kids. He would have 20 that were really badass. After end of the practice, before the night of a game, he would make us get on the free throw line and shoot free throws. You should get 2 shots. We kept going until someone, like if you missed one, probably bad. You have to go on that side. If you made 2, you stay on this side. And eventually someone's going to miss. And there's only like 5 spots open that are left, because he's got his 10. So the last people that started last week, they don't even get a pass either. But he gets to pick, he picks them in front of you. He says, this is my starting 5. They go over there. The next 5, you guys figure it out. He cared. He did not. It was not emotional. It was about like, can you perform under pressure? And so what? So what about your feelings? Oh, and by the way, you guys, next game, you're going to be back in this group and you have to do it all over again. But that's life.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Don't allow your feelings to affect your future. No. Something like 100%. So something I was looking into is transition from basketball to bodybuilding. And it, something that really resonated with me, with James Clear, he talks a lot about identity-based habits. So when you attach your identity to your job, your career, instead of saying, I play basketball, mm-hmm. I'm a basketball player,
right,
then you become that thing. People know you for that thing, and it's right. a lot easier to focus all your effort and energy into it. Now you're at a situation where you're suddenly realizing that you know basketball isn't the way that you're going to become a pro,
right?
And you're at this moment where you don't know which way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Could you just talk us through that moment and that kind of realization and kind of how that felt and what attracted you then to start thinking about bodybuilding?
You start to realize very quickly where you stand amongst your teammates. Because now you're on a team as a freshman and you have sophomores, juniors, and seniors, and you're just fighting for playing time. And the coach decides, you know, based on what he thinks. But as a freshman, you're supposed to get some minutes, you know, so then they can actually have that litmus test of saying, like, okay, well, can he handle this pressure? Can he do what we think he can do? And what's very difficult is to try to understand why they make the decisions they make, especially when they go wrong. So that for me was very difficult because we weren't winning. And I'm like, gosh, damn, like I can see, especially when you're sitting the bench and you're trying to just analyze, like you're just looking at the game for what it truly is. And you know your teammates and you understand their intangibles, you understand their patterns. Like I could tell, like if someone was going to miss their assignment on a defensive switch, you know, I could very well know, like, okay, this guy's not going to make the shot because he's going to be off balance as he comes off this double screen. It's going to be very hard. So then why did he pass it to him? Why didn't he look at the second option? So that's what I'm going to do when I get in the game. So if I don't get in the game, I'm like, ugh. And you just feel like, ugh. And it just becomes like kind of bitching and moaning a little bit. And that produces a lot of disappointment and depression and resentment as to why I even came in the first place. And that caused a lot of spiraling out where I didn't want to even be on this earth anymore. And then I had to come to realize that I have more life to live and that if I continue to move forward and look upward instead of downward and bitch and moan and complain, something will open up for me. I don't know what it is. And there was a point in time in my high school career where I was asked about my thoughts and goals, you know, of moving not just into college, but what's going to happen after. And I told the Seattle newspaper, I was like, yeah, it's wild that I can remember it. I said, I don't know if I'll actually play in the NBA, but I know I'll be pro at something. And yeah, I had to rely on that when I wasn't playing ball and realize, okay, you can be pro at something else because there's more millionaires at that time at Microsoft than they were in the NBA. And you're going to college for business and IT. So yeah, like life ain't over, even though you think it is, even though you want to be here, you still have a job to do. And that's to graduate college and see where that takes you. Lo and behold, bodybuilding opens itself up, reveals itself. And once it revealed itself, it was like a new path for me that I had to explore. And once I explored it, I loved it. And then when I competed, I won. And that changed my whole trajectory. You know, I was like, and then it went like, hold on. Let's see. And you're not going, nope, no more basketball. No more basketball. No, I want to do it. Nope. And you're doing so well at this. Now you pour your whole entire being into this. And it did make me feel really special. It made me feel more confident. And I made new friends. And, you know, I'm very happy that I never became an NBA player. You know, through that heartache, I was able to experience something that only a couple of three other people have experienced. I'm 7-time tied with the man that everybody knows. Everybody knows Arnold. And Lee Haney and Ronnie Coleman have 8. And I'm just very blessed. And at that time, I didn't even know I could compete. But I'm having these conversations. It allows me to reflect and realize that, you know, life has zero rehearsal whatsoever. And you just have to play your best hand and just keep coming back.
There's this old story of a Chinese farmer called The Outcome Is Not the Outcome. I don't know if you've heard it, but basically he wakes up, his horse disappears. The villagers say, oh, that's unfortunate. And he goes, I don't know, we'll see. The horse comes back the next day with another horse, and they said, oh, how fortunate. And he goes, I don't know, we'll see. His son jumps on the horse and breaks his leg. How unfortunate. And the farmer says, we'll see. There was a war going on in another country, and they're rounding up a lot of the young guys, but because his son had broke his leg, they were like, oh, that was lucky. And he says, I don't know, we'll see. And the whole point of it is, you don't know the outcome yet. Mm-hmm. You don't know whether something is good or bad. You don't know if something's the worst to have ever happened to you or the best, because at the time it might have felt that basketball was, you know, not having basketball was the worst thing ever. But if you knew what you knew now, imagine if you succeeded in basketball.
Yeah.
And
I wouldn't trade.
You wouldn't have now.
Yeah, I wouldn't trade.
And I always think about that when it comes to bad things happening, because you're like, you don't know yet if this is the best thing to have ever happened to you. And I think when I see a lot of people struggling with things, a lot of people going through dark times, I remind them that this might be the best thing to ever happen. It might not feel like it at the moment, right, but in about 10 years' time, you might be able to look back and go, thank you for that.
It's so true. And to having, whether it be a coach or a family member or someone, you know, relatively close to you to give that, that's great advice. Because I still remember, even like I had an uncle who, you know, every young boy usually has a girl that he loves in high school. And it's like, I she's my everything. He was like, that girl you're dating, it ain't going to be everything. Okay, just enjoy what you're doing, and more than likely, you're going to move on. Yeah, I'm very happy that I was able to move on. So, yeah, just having the willingness to experience the unknown is how I look at it. Because, yeah, it's a really cool gift that we can't see further ahead. It's really good. Because we all think that we should, oh man, it'd be really good to see my future. You sure? Because maybe if you were told that, you wouldn't do the work to get that.
Or go through the pain that it took to get there. Yeah, 100%. I want to talk about Mortal Kombat now.
Yeah.
I remember you saying this, and I thought, there is some deep philosophy on Mortal Kombat here.
Yeah.
And it just reminded me that, and I'll let you talk about it, please, Phil, because I just think it's brilliant.
Yeah, so huge fan of the game, but it was more about me applying myself into the game. And it was like, okay, it's not about choose your character. You are who you are. And, you know, to get to the mountaintop, you have to go against a lot of opposition. And you start defeating these people. But at some point, you know, within the game, you have to test your might, test your strength, right? And then there comes a point where you have to see yourself, beat yourself, see yourself. And we've seen this in Mortal Kombat. You play, and you have to beat yourself to then go on to the next two rounds. And that's hard. It's really hard to do. And you know, for me, it was about going into the Olympia high on life, and then you get second place, and then you're just like, oh yeah, it feels good to be second because it doesn't weigh, you know, the same amount of pressure and stuff like that. Well, guess what, Phil? Like, you have to meet this. You have to meet you. You're already good enough to win the damn thing. When you're second at the Olympia, it means that, like, you're next in line pretty much, as long as you keep plugging away. But you have to conquer whatever fears you have, whatever weaknesses you have, which is fear, usually, and show no, I mean, weakness whatsoever, and be vulnerable, submit to these things and say, okay, this is what you're insecure about. This is what you need to do. You're going to do this every day. If I'm going to declare that I'm going to be the champion, I can't just say it out loud to make it look cool in a magazine or on Instagram. I have to say it whether people hear me or not. I need to tell myself, and then I need to do it. And I was able to do that, obviously. But then I realized, oh man, I have a really good opportunity right now. I'm 31 years old. How many do you want to win? Okay, let's just dream big. Lee Haney and Coleman got 8. I want to get freaking 10. And then I realized I got to go through that same process of Mortal Kombat again and then realize, okay, well, the first level, and then I go from Mortal Kombat to like a Call of Duty, like you prestiged the first time, and then you got to go at it again and again and again and again. And when you say again, the body is so dynamic that you cannot use the same diet, the same training, the same, your philosophy is going to change. But it is kind of like when you say, with a special operators sharpening the blade, you're the tip of the spear and all these things, so you have to sharpen the blade to be able to defend yourself and to continue to defend that title and to kill whoever comes your way. Whatever demons come, you got to be able to slam them all down, because it starts from within. So I use those video games to kind of remind myself, okay, that this is how you would do it. Okay, you got to be more methodical, you got to be intelligent, you got to do the self audit, be accountable. Okay, look at your diet. Did that really work? Because around that fourth Mr. Olympia, I, along with my coach, Hani Rambo, we both looked at each other and people were like, what are you guys freaked out about? You just won. And we're like, you thinking what I'm thinking? And he was like, yep, this diet don't work anymore. Because we won, but it wasn't like what we had the previous year in 2013. And that's when we realized, oh, shoot. We got to really sit down and recognize who Phil Heath really is. And that's a lot. So reevaluating and reinventing yourself, I think we all have to do that. But the great thing is that, what does that mean? We're transcending into a greater version of self. So we have to do that work. And it's, for me, it was more, that exploration was very enlightening, because I knew that if I could achieve that, I was going to create more distance from the competitors. Yeah,
it's a massive shift, because from what I see, Phil, with your whole Olympia, coming third in 2008, that was a realization that it's possible. And as you said, you know, you've got two more places to go, so you're going into the next year with the energy and the focus and the drive to do one better.
Mm-hmm.
Then we get to 2009. Food poisoning, fifth place. Once again, the hunger to come back and go, okay,
yeah,
we need to come back. And it's, once again, this underdog energy that you've spoken about. Then comes, I think, 2010, second place. You have this exhale,
mm-hmm.
which you spoke about, which, you know, you said you were relieved that you came second.
Yes.
Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so in Breaking Olympia, there's a moment in the film where I explain placing second. And when they named, when Bob Chicarillo, every year he has the top two guys, and he says, the next name I read will be crowned as the Mr. Olympia. And he said, Jay Cutler. And I go, whew. And initially I didn't understand, but just like if it was basketball, I looked at the game tape. And I started looking at my body language, and I was like, wait a damn minute, let me rewind this. Why did I do that? And I'm looking at myself, why the hell did you do that, Phil? You son of a, you know what I mean? I'm starting to get pissed, because I'm like, you know, you really could have won this thing. And you're being scared. But it can't stop there. We got to do the digging and figure out why. And I came to realize that it didn't have to revolve around me beating Jay Cutler. It had to be totally about becoming the 13th Mr. Olympia. What does that mean to me? And when I was able to describe it and write it down and stare at it and then own it, I didn't really have to do any interviews that sounded like false bravado anymore. It was more like, I didn't have to sell it to you. I was him. And that really propelled me into becoming the champion that I am today, is that acknowledging the fear, writing it down, staring at it, and asking yourself, do you want to still live there? And what is on the other side of it? A man who is fearless. And it was the best thing that ever happened. But I needed to see that, and I'm very thankful And that was like a godsend right there. Like, Phil, I'm going to give you something. You're going to see this. You better pay attention. Because it truly was one of the most defining moments in my life, especially in my bodybuilding career. Because how many people in that situation would be okay just being second, because everybody kind of feels sorry for him, and you know, it's okay, you know, this and that, you know, he's your friend, man. Like, what, you know, some people don't go after promotions because it may rub that other friend the wrong way, or the pressure, you know, of being the man. You know, I still remember, like, in high school, not asking a girl out because I was, oh man, my friend went out with her, and but they're not going out anymore, but I really like her, man, you know, and I didn't even have the courage to say hi, you know, like those type of things. But, you know, you just learn very quickly that being a coward, like, you are being a coward. You're just being scared. And do you really, really want it? And I'm so glad, like, again, I'm just so happy that I just proved to myself that I freaking want it. And I actually had Jay Cutler call me one time, and he just flat out said it. He was like, you can't be concerned about our friendship when it comes to these things. It's not like we're fighting and stuff. You know, we're fighting for the title, but at the same time, we're fighting against ourselves to go be the best. And that was a great level of advice too. So, you know, I ran with it. You know, when people, one thing about me I will say is that when people pour into me, I use it. I don't just like let it go one ear and out the other. You know, I try my best anyway, you know, to make sure I utilize it, because it is your energy that you're exchanging.
Something that I see with a lot of successful people is a lot of people talk about the fear of failure, as in if they fail that they, you know, they won't get back up. But what I find with successful people is they love that. They love, you know, people criticizing, people saying he'll never do it, because one of the most powerful energies in the world is spite. I will show you. Yeah. And one of the things that I find with a lot of people who, you know, in a way, just mentally and physically sometimes self-sabotage, it's not the fear of failure, it's the fear of success. It's the fear that if I get the thing that I have worked so hard towards, I'm almost afraid of the person that I have to be to stay there now. Because it's a totally different mindset and a totally different energy getting there as opposed to staying there. So we now fast forward to 2011. We're down to the last two, and your name gets called. What changed in your head before that call out that was different in 2010?
That it had to be me. It had to be me. And just thinking of my, you know, you're praying, and it's like, it has to be me. I know I did it. I did the work. Just say my name. You know, you're just like, say my name, say it. And then knowing that you're ready for it to be said, and then it comes, and you're just like, oh, thank God, man. And within a millisecond, nanosecond, whatever, it's like every why in the road is like super synapses, like all these images when you were told no and you still kept going, all these times where you're depressed, kept going, got knocked down, kept going. I mean, everything. And then it's like you open your eyes and tears are flowing because you know that it all made sense. It all made sense. It all got me to this point. And I was able to recognize that. And yeah, I mean, I was able to leverage the pain and make it into something special. And I know that I did something, in my opinion, very iconic, because, you know, it wasn't an open title. It was something that had to be earned to succeed someone else. And it was a great moment in our history of our sport, you know, because we were able to see two guys who were friends, and he was able to say some nice things because I earned it. Those things only happen when that person knows. Who wants to pass the baton? Who wants to pass the torch to someone that doesn't really deserve it? You don't do it. You'd walk off stage and, you know, yeah, I'm happy for him. But when Jay had those kind words to say, is because he knew that I did the work, and he knew I was going to represent. And ultimately, you want the respect from your peers. Yeah.
So there's the first one, then the second, then the third. And what I'm what I was trying to get into is understanding the mindset of going from that underdog to now improving time and time again. And there was a guy, I'm not sure if you remember his name, I think his name's Kai Green.
Yeah.
That so badly wanted what you had and was willing to put the work in to get it. How important was that to help you get those seven Olympia titles?
Oh man, I mean, to watch his work ethic, incredible. I can't say a bad thing about him because he put the time in. He was eating clean year round. I would take a couple months off and just try to relax and try to have some balance. And then I realized, like, you can't do that. This guy is like hoping you slack. And we had different methodologies of like training and diet and stuff. So I still had to be me, but I had to know that if I'm traveling on tour and he's on tour and he's going to the gym at midnight and I'm asleep, or if I'm out drinking, then I'm stupid. I am so dumb. So it was like an accountability partner. And then eventually, I mean, we're probably both pushing each other in that regard. But every hero needs a villain. And then I became the villain and he became some other people's hero. But it didn't matter. And I just enjoyed the competition. I enjoyed the energy, to be quite honest. I mean, who wouldn't? Only a chump, you know, would look at competition and kind of be like, oh, I don't want that. For me, I'm like, no, I want that. I want you to bring it. And I let everything sting. Because I remember he beat me at the Arnold Classic in 2010. And I told myself after that show, because it was very depressing, because I always wanted one. And, you know, I was very close to getting it. And I remember making a vow. I declared, I said, I will never lose to this guy again. So I have to own that and have a commitment to that commitment. And I'm sure he did not care. And he had his own mind of saying like, hey, I'm going to win and I'm going to be the man. He's going to have to chase me now. I'm going to, you know, make the money for my family. I'm going to do this. And he was making money for his family, but still he wanted to have his name with that title attached. So to prevent someone like that, that's so formidable, like it took a lot of effort, because if you see the guy off season, you would swear he's Mr. Olympia. Kai Green was probably a guy that, like, in street clothes, you would say he's Mr. Olympia 365 days a year, until it came down to those two freaking days. And then Phil Heath goes in and slices his freaking head off, because the predator always dies. And that's how I, know, like, he was the predator. I'm like, yeah, the predator always dies in the movie. Arnold killed him. And actually, he was so good. Arnold was so good in that movie. The predator did what? He killed himself. And I had to slay him. I had to prove that it was not worth for him to come back here. And that's it helped. It really helped. And we leveraged each other and each other's fans, you know, like we leveraged each other. In fact, I mean, you know, I always make a joke. I say, man, I tell Kai, I'm like, you know how much money we made during that rivalry time selling shirts and hats and merch? It was wild, you know. But I missed him after 2014 because no one could really remember this third place person in 2012 and 13 and 14. No one can remember because it was the Phil and Kai show. So it would have been nice to be in the peak of my career. But who knows? You know, maybe he would have won one. I don't know. But he's got to live with that too. But yeah, if he walked through this door right now, there might be some furniture moving.
Something I've written down here is... I just came up this, the enemy energy, using the power of having rivals to drive energy and focus to succeed. I talk a lot about invisible enemies. It's something that I do when I'm doing something. I haven't got that rival, so I imagine that people are talking shit behind my back.
There you go.
And then it's like, well, you wait and see. Mm-hmm. And it's such a powerful energy when used, you know, in the right space.
Right.
And of course, something that you just spoke about there, Phil, is that alter ego of... you know, the dream killer.
Yeah.
And having to become this kind of character in order to succeed.
Yes.
Talk to me a little bit about the dream killer. Where did that come from? And you know, we've spoken a little bit about that mentality, yeah. but that shift in you to say, right, I need to become this, you know, to a certain extent, to some kind of a heel, or, you know, as you said, every antagonist, yeah. agonist-antagonist person.
To, I figure to you have to be willing to be the heel in someone else's eyes. You're the hero in your own story. And around that time, that was social media. So social media is going to dislike someone that is dominant, that comes in year after year after year and is beating everyone. And my data was derived from watching Ronnie Coleman. He was hated at one point. And people today don't even know that, because they those emotions they had back then are gone. It was like his third or fourth Olympiad. I remember watching it, and people were booing. And he literally was on stage giving a speech, and he looked in the camera and said, "You can boo if you want to. I won." And of course he was upset. But I remember the same thing happened to Jay Cutler too. I remember the same thing happened to him after he won his first two, and then he lost that third one. And the same people who were rooting for him to beat Ronnie all those years turned on him. I saw reporters, I saw, you know, real journalists, insiders, you know, coming to me because I'm the new guy, talking shit about him. So I knew, okay, it's probably going to happen to you, Phil. And around that time, that was, you know, around the time where Tom Brady was winning a lot as well, and people hated him. And I remember Jim Mangan, our league president, literally gave me the trophy. It was like, "Ah, don't worry about them. You're the Tom Brady. You're the champ. Who cares?" But it was always difficult. And I had to sit with that 1 year, and I said, "You know what I'm going to do? They're trying to kill my dreams, and I'm going to fucking kill theirs first. You got to beat the bully before you get you. You got to see it coming." And I remember watching that film. I think it was Dark Knight. And at the end, Batman is riding off, and the kid was with Commissioner Gordon. He was like, why is he let them chase him? And he says, because he can take it. So I thought, by saying I'm the dream killer, I was like, that's okay. Reporters, vloggers, whatever, come on. I can take it. In fact, now I know who the enemies really are. Because not one of those journalists ever came up to me and was like, "Phil, like, dude, I love you, man. Don't do this." They reported and talked trash about me, my girlfriend, now wife. I saw it all. I saw the ugliness. And I leveraged the hell out of it. I call myself the dream killer so much that they were like, I walk in the room and no friends. The only problem I had with it was when I would try to just be chill, the competitors and even fans, I guess in terms of like wrestling, I went over so well that they didn't know when I turned it off or like minimized it. They thought I was that dude all the time. So I had to wear that mask like throughout. So I then would change it from dream killer to the hero villain and all this other stuff. But I loved it, man. If someone called me dream killer, like when I'm walking in the studio, I'd be like, hell yeah, dude. But you can't kill him. You can't kill that alter ego. I think we were talking about this earlier before we started. I don't think it's necessary to kill him. I think it's good to put him in a box. You need him. You need him for when it's time to ride. You need it for like disaster. You know what I mean? That ego that we say, oh, you need to kill that ego, I think is very ignorant, because what if there is war? So if you're a soldier and you have these special set of skills and you kill that ego that got you through boot camp, that got you through these missions, that got you through life, and you totally kill him and something happens, you don't know what to do. You'd have lost your whole edge. And I know, I'm sure for you, as it is for me, that's the last thing we ever want. So I have that alter ego, and I'm glad that I can say that I created it based on what life was giving me. Life presented me an opportunity to explore what that looked like, what it felt like. And if it didn't work, I probably would have pivoted and did something different. But it freaking served me, man. It served me when, you know, my dad was dying and people were talking shit. It served me when I had a nasty divorce and people were running their mouth, because now I got a new girlfriend who's now my wife, and people were running their mouth and trying to create fog as a distraction for me to get what I want. It served me when, you know, I had a supplement company with my freaking name on it, and I had people rob it and just dismember it by their fraudulent actions. It served me when people would go online and just say that I'm glad that your dad and now your stepmom's gonna die, and I hope your real mom dies too. It served me when I read in Flex magazine when the judging criteria changed and said this year we will have the fans vote in on who they want as the champion, and that will person who they vote for will be the people's champion, and that vote will count to the grand total on the Olympia judging panel stage. How do you think that made me feel? My feelings were not thought about, but what it told me was that I was so freaking good that they had to change the game. So basically I changed it, but I had to use it. I had to use the alter ego to just like, don't bother me. Don't bother me. Someone says something, don't bother me. I'm still going, I'm still eating, I'm still doing the cardio, I'm still coming in shredded, full round. And, you know, now I can look back and say I'm glad that I did it because I look freaking amazing. And I created a standard that when you go on social media and some new champion arises, they always compare them to me. All those top IGs, and they do. There'll be a person that wins the Arnold Classic. There's a person that's going to win the Olympia this year, and they're going to compare their best and say, what do you think his best versus Phil Heath? It's done all the time. And I sit back and I say, that feels refreshing, because I'm sure that that person that's vlogging that probably didn't even like me, but they appreciate what I produced. And that came from using what was available. You know, and I think everybody should be using what's available. What tools are available? Be resourceful. If you got to have a mean streak, a dark side, like Tim Grover would talk about having a dark side, use it. But then you don't use it on your spouse. You don't use it kicking your dog. Don't be a dick. Like, you know what I mean? But when it comes to being highly competitive, you do whatever it takes. Otherwise, you're the Sugar Shane Mosley that should have beat Mayweather and tagged him one time and didn't pounce on him afterwards, and you're just the nice guy that won four times. That's who you are.
So much John Pat FL. I think one thing that sprung to mind is David Goggins in his Never Finish book. He talked about a mixtape.
Mm.
And what he used to do is he used to read out comments on social media, record them, and then play them on his run. People think there's something like, I'm like, the energy that comes from negativity can be so powerful when used it, you know, used correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And I absolutely love that, because I can just, firstly, I was like, well, David Goggins doesn't run with headphones, but I'm just like to have that mixtape of energy to drive in is exactly what, you know, you did then. I pulled a quote from, it was American actor Cary Grant, and he said, I pretended to be someone I wanted to be until finally I became that person, or he became me. And I just pondered on that when it comes to, you know, holding a standard for yourself, having to create this character to be who you, you know, who you want to be. And I think it's super, super powerful, and something that you said there about being respected versus being liked. And I think a lot of people should focus on respect over being liked, because, you know, a quote that I say is you can rescue an old lady from a burning building and there'll still be someone out there that thinks you're a prick.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are focused on trying to get everybody to like you, then you might end up losing some of your respect.
100%. You know, I think a lot of people don't even know what they like. Vanilla one day, strawberry the next day. You know, when it came down to the whole bodybuilding thing, and, you know, this goes to all the people that, you know, are personalities online, influencers, micro-influencers, all this stuff. You know, you're basing your value off of someone pressing a like button or maybe a comment. You got to love yourself first. You can't just like yourself. You got to love yourself. You got to love what you do. I think once you love what you do and you live that life and you in its most authentic self, you know, people will like it. People will love it. They will respect it. Oh, I don't really love Phil Heath, but I sure respect his work ethic, man. Because what he said, he did. No one can say that when I would go on that, you know, a YouTube or something, someone interviewed me, I would tell you the truth. I would tell you that I'm going to kill them all. I would tell you that I'm going to do it. And it was always said, as long as Phil Heath is at his best, or if he never got hurt, he would still be winning. That is great, because that came with respect. I remember a judge said one time, even if I didn't like you, you're just that good. That's respect. In 2013, when I had one call out, that you'll never, I mean, I don't want to say you'll never see that again, but with that lineup, with those champion bodybuilders, with, man, from Kai Greene to Dennis Wolfe to Branch Warren to Victor Martinez to Jay Cutler to Big Ramy to Dexter Roden, like all these guys, and you get one call out, man, you got the, they gave me the nod. They were like, we respect Phil, man. Like, he just brought it, man. And who wouldn't want the respect from people that adjudicate them? Like, most boys grow up wanting the nod from their father, because it's a sign of ultimate respect. Some young boys that turn men never get it. Maybe their dads are just hard asses, or maybe they just see the potential within them because they share DNA, and they've given them every tool they could have, and they, and that kid just won't, it refuses to step forth into that level of greatness. But I want that nod. But the ultimate nod is obviously from Most High at the end. But while I'm here, I have some goals. And it's going to require a lot of sacrifice, a lot of self-talk, positive talk, but a lot of accountability and just being unafraid of the unknown. And like you said earlier, which I thought was fantastic, is you really just have to embrace this journey. And just almost not too high, not too low. You just have to say it is what it is. And what I can do is be great. But I have to answer the call. And I have to put foot to ass. And I can't expect you to do it for me. That's the even bigger thing. I think a lot of time right now we're waiting for someone to save us. And my wife would say this all the time. She'd be like, ain't no one here to save you, Phil. No one's here to, you got to save yourself. You got to deliver yourself. Yeah. That is something that, and I'm very fortunate to have a wife that actually thinks at that high level. She's a competitive person, and I think that's why we make a great team. But man, like, if more people, especially younger people, realize that they have their whole life ahead of them and know that their life will not be roses and ponies and, you know, like just candy, and it's got to be filled with some turmoil. Otherwise, you're probably living an average life. I think the ones 100%. That have the potential to do something great, that decide to live an average life, yeah, they don't have any problems. Yeah, my life is great, man. I'm, you know, I'm just chilling and stuff. Yeah, you're the guy that should have been a billionaire. You make $100,000. You're the guy that should have been 10-time Miss Olympia, but you decided to do the different category because it was easy for you. You know, like, it is what it is. And it's very interesting because, to summarize all of it, there's people that won't step forth into it, and then they hate on the guy that did that, and they hate him because that person, guy or girl, probably had less talent but more grit. And I just think, when you know, when you're talented, it's your obligation to explore it. It's your obligation to explore it. And in the end, it's your job, even as we're doing this right now, is to share. So then people can get out of their own head, get into their heart, put foot to ass, and take no prisoners, man. Otherwise, you're going to live a life at the end of it, and you won't have an identity because you never created one.
A couple more questions, Phil. And I think one that really stuck to me in the film was your whole rehab. So you had hernia surgery.
Yes.
And I want to talk about 2020, and it's something that you said, and it was coming third at 2020, And you said, I was able to look at myself in the mirror and love myself for the first time.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that? And what I mean by that is, because I remember you in the film, you were in the lift and said, look, I'm happy with this. I'm mm-hmm. content with this.
Yeah.
What was going through your head at that third place? And then for you to say that, where were you at that time?
Finality. I was at a point where I placed third in 2008 and I placed third in 2020. Felt like there was a circle within it. Circle that was created, and within it had a lot of cool things that occurred, and that I realized through all the pain and sacrifice, I really loved it, but I had to realize I have to love me, and by loving myself, I had to recognize that no matter what happened in 2020 regarding the result, I had to love myself through it. And I still have to today. It's not something that you get over. I still think of, damn, like, if only I would have done this, or if I would have did this, or, you know, watching the doc at the premiere the other night, I'm already scared. I'm like, oh, I could have done this. But then I say, Phil, you're always going to critique. But to what level? Is it a level of just like, yeah, if you could have went back in time, yeah, you're gonna do that, but it's not of a negative place. You're not talking trash about yourself, so you're still loving yourself. You're just like, man, I could have hit it like a little bit different here. I could have did this. I could have did that. You're just a savant. Like, you're just a purist. Yeah. I'm a purist, and I understand I'm a purist. But yeah, loving myself was the key to even doing the show in the first place, because I didn't do 2019 because I wanted to know what the experience was like of just having a summer, being able to watch. Sheree and I were watching prejudging at a Mexican restaurant, and the waiter comes over and says, aren't you supposed to be somewhere? Isn't it the Olympia? Like, and I was like, actually, we're watching it right here. And then the following night, we're at a friend's house watching it, and Shaquille O'Neal FaceTimes me, and he's like, dude, where the hell are you? And I was like, I'm at my boy's house, man. We're all... And then that I realized, like, 2020 is my calling. I got to do it. And then COVID happened, and it was just like, okay, Phil, how bad do you want this? And then I said, you want it really bad, and you want to be able to share how you loved yourself through it, you know. And that was an injury that sidelined my career, but I'm just thankful that I was able to push through it.
Last question, Phil, and I think this is such an important question that I get asked a lot, and no doubt you get asked a lot. What would you tell your 20-year-old self, knowing what you know now?
Get ready, because it's going to be one hell of a ride. And hold on tight and breathe and enjoy every freaking moment, because it's all going to be worth it.
Your brand new documentary, Breaking Olympia, documents this entire journey, and I watched it last week. Absolutely incredible. How did it feel for you kind of reliving that entire life? What feelings came watching that back?
Fulfillment, appreciation, gratitude, sadness, relief, but complete gratitude. To have this documentary, to have a great director with Brett Harvey, to have Adam Scorgi of Scorgi Productions, to have Danny Garcia and Dwayne Johnson of Seven Bucks step in, and obviously the support with Universal. I mean, I have a studio release. That's not something that if someone were to tell me that would even be possible, that I would even believe it. And seeing the intro, it was the intro at that premiere that I'm like, watching every person, and then they're like, they started clapping because they saw the globe, they saw Universal, and it's something that you would normally see at all movies, right? But with this, everybody's intention was like, this is actually happening. Phil Heath is a part of something this big, and everyone in there was a bodybuilding fan, some of the people were in there that were in it, but they were like, I could sense a sense of pride. They were all proud and they were all happy for me. So it I'm just excited that it's here and it's going to be out, you know, here in a couple of days. And yeah, everybody's going to, I think there's a lot of goodness in this, a lot of greatness in this. Yeah.
Where can people watch it, Phil?
Oh, on all VOD platforms. Yeah, it's everywhere. I ain't gonna lie. Like, I'm freaking pumped that it's just everywhere, man. You know, Prime Video, you know, Apple, like Google Play, like all these different places. And I think it's gonna be something people look at over and over again. I have had friends that went to the premiere and they're already waiting to watch it again. So I'm very happy about that.
Phil, I finish every podcast with the same quote. And it's, what you put in your body affects how you look and how you feel. What you put in your head affects what you think and what you do. And today you've been filling your heads with me, Gelderton, and the legend, Phil Heath. Phil, thank you ever so much for coming on the Mindset with Muscle podcast today.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate you. None of you people can tell me to stop. My town, my crown. We know what it takes to be reaching the top. We're reaching the top. We're reaching the top. We know what it takes.